You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, Jim.
Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
Okay, almost Happy New Year.
Almost. Let me introduce us and explain what we're going to have to say about the new year. I'm Robert Wright. This is The Wright Show on Blogging Heads TV, available via video streaming and audio podcast. You are Jim Loeb, proprietor of the increasingly famous Loeblog, the foreign policy site. That's L-O-B-E-L-O-G, one word, the first syllable being your last name.
True.
And what else do you, is there anything else you want to say about yourself? Like you won an award or something recently, or Loeblog won an award or not so recently or something.
Oh, that was about a year ago.
Okay, then never mind that. Ancient history. You're only as good as yesterday's story.
I know. I know. It's true.
But let me explain what we're going to do. So we're taping this a couple of days before New Year's. Now, what we've done in the past on Blogging Heads is have like one big New Year's like show where we look back at the stories of the past year and try to anticipate the big stories of the next year. But this year, it's just totally clear what the big story of last year was and what the big story of next year will be. It's Donald Trump and what he represents. So I thought I would do a series of conversations, starting with this one, in which I talk to various people and assess the Trump situation. Now, when I talk to you, I will be focusing on foreign policy, which involves the whole question of whether he is going to bring on the apocalypse. And we will answer that question definitively. There will be no doubt by the end of this conversation. But so basically in the coming, you know, week or two, I'm going to have some more of these conversations. It'll be on Blogging Heads. I'm starting off on foreign policy and with you. Does this sound okay?
I'm flattered and honored at the same time.
Well, okay, well, these are not mutually exclusive options. You can be both.
That's true. That is true.
Because I was trying to both flatter and honor you.
No, I wasn't trying to be paradoxical. These were the emotions that just came
swept
over me.
Through you?
At the moment, yeah.
As I bestowed the honor and flattery on you. So here's the deal. Why don't we start out by asking the question, like, what would one, if you just went by what Donald Trump was saying during the campaign, how would you characterize his foreign policy if you just took him at his word? So, in other words, was there coherence to begin with in a Trumpian foreign policy?
I didn't see much coherence except in the very broadest sense of the word, and that would be that most of what he said corresponded to what others have called a kind of Jacksonian view of the world, which is basically kind of leave us alone, but don't try to get in our way. And if you cross us, you're going to pay big time.
Right.
Which, in a sense, describes his personality, in part.
Yeah, although, I mean, that's kind of an alarming thing to say, because it doesn't, because he defines crossing him very broadly.
He does, and yeah, he has a, yeah, it's, I think it's very easy to cross him.
I mean, the classic Jacksonian foreign policy would be, I think would involve, right, a kind of a realist's sense of restraint, generally speaking. Like, we're not looking for trouble.
Right.
We're not going to be readily drawn into conflicts, but if you're a true, genuine threat, we'll totally blow you away. Whereas Donald Trump personally perceives virtually everything as a personal affront. So far, I mean, that's a slight exaggeration, but you take my point.
I agree with you. Yeah,
okay.
I think that's true. And you have this very, you know, his use of the words America first. I mean, it's a very, very nationalistic,
right,
and obviously somewhat xenophobic and nativist on the immigration issue,
right,
protectionist on the trade issue. I mean, generally speaking, you know, it seems pretty consistent with a Jacksonian view.
Right. And with such figures as, like, Pat Buchanan. I mean, it picks up on a strand of conservative thought, right?
Yeah, but Buchanan is a what we call a paleocon, and he borrows a lot of paleoconservatism from people like Buchanan. But
I mean, the nativism,
Buchanan, I think, was much more restrained. I mean, he wouldn't talk about like bombing the shit out of ISIS or. I don't know. I mean, they're definitely parallels, but I don't see him as exactly in the same tradition. Yeah, I mean, in part because Trump's worldview is still kind of amorphous and unformed and internally contradictory on many issues. I mean, Buchanan, for example, would never be as strong as Trump now appears to be on Israel. Quite the contrary.
That is certainly true. And it's a good question how Trump wound up there. I think some of his supporters during the election would not have anticipated that and would not have welcomed it. I mean, he did, I guess, start saying during the campaign some of the standard pro-Israel things.
Well, once he appeared before the AIPAC annual policy conference, he was well on the road. And I don't remember exactly the timing vis-a-vis the AIPAC conference and Adelson's decision to fund.
This is Sheldon Adelson, the...
Yeah. I've been told recently he goes more by Adelson. But,
oh, does he?
So I've been trying to correct my previous pronunciation. But, yeah, in any event, after Sheldon gave what he had to give or began giving... I think that influenced Trump perhaps somewhat, and he moved in a very, very strongly Zionist, ultra-Zionist direction, and we see that, of course, most recently in his tweets regarding in advance of Kerry's speech and after the abstention at the UN, and in his tentative nomination or real nomination of David Friedman, his bankruptcy lawyer, who is as fanatic as it comes with respect to Greater Israel and the settlements and other issues like that.
Yeah. Okay. So, and it's funny, though, you know, I don't think of that as being as consequential as I might have 5 or 10 years ago. There's a sense in which there's so much other stuff going on in the world that Israel no longer looms as relatively large as it used to. I guess the other reason is I had kind of given up on a two-state solution anyway, and now Trump is going to make it even less likely than I had thought, which was not very likely at all. But do you get the sense that Israel isn't looming as large in the landscape of actual foreign policy decisions that the president's going to have to make that have consequence?
I mean... I don't know. If for example, they decide to move the embassy to Jerusalem and they actually make a formal and official announcement, things could happen in reaction to that would definitely grab the headlines. There are many other critical issues out there that some of which could also suddenly blossom into full-fledged crises. And that, of course, would also grab the media's attention. So I would say at this point, I mean, I wouldn't write off Israel-related issues as unlikely to be a major focus of public and the administration's attention in the first 6 months. I think it's very possible some things could happen.
Yeah, and I guess the nightmare or a kind of nightmare would be it getting intertwined with the larger, you know, the Palestinian situation has remained pretty thoroughly insulated from jihadism in a certain sense, right? Broader jihadism. It's not like Israel can plausibly claim, and I think Netanyahu would like to be able to plausibly claim that there's a bunch of ISIS operatives running around the West Bank, right? But there hasn't been that kind of connection.
No, I mean... I think you can say that especially for the Al-Qaeda founders and the earlier plotters, 9/11, Palestine was always part of their bill of particulars, and for some it was the first bill of particulars, even though those individuals weren't necessarily Palestinian. But I guess you could say that's faded somewhat, what with, you know, the U.S. invasion of Iraq, the so-called Arab Spring or Arab Awakening in 2011, and the consequences of that as well. Obviously, the civil war in Syria, the campaign in Yemen that's led by the Saudis, which hasn't gotten that much major attention, growing rivalry between Iran and Saudi Arabia that show few signs of abating. I mean, that's just for the Middle East. I mean,
right. And that's kind of what I meant, is that when you think of the, for what are the several most like alarming and potentially explosive things going on in the Middle East, you don't think of Israel right away because there's so much stuff going on around it. But,
yeah.
But this, the Iraq invasion brings us back to like the question of Trump's foreign policy, because before the election, he gained a certain amount of support from the left and also from the anti-war right. But there were people on the left who said, yes, he understands that this interventionism has gotten us into trouble and that the problem with American foreign policy is it's still run by the people who got us in this trouble, at least in terms of the think tank infrastructure and so on in Washington, and he wants to throw them all out. He's going to be very reluctant to intervene. And I always thought it was naive of leftists to put hopes in him, partly just because he's so unpredictable, but also because you could see that it, you know, this was, this part of his foreign policy that you might call realist was paired with a lot of belligerent rhetoric as it applied to, like, ISIS and the war on terror. And to some extent, a certain kind of, not maybe militarism, but a certain kind of belligerence toward China, toward Iran, and so on. So this is the reason I didn't see him as real coherently anything.
Yeah, not just unpredictable, however. I mean, I would also say ignorant, which, of course, contributes to unpredictability.
Right.
You know, again, the man could not remember that he was for the Iraq war before he was against the Iraq war.
Well, he didn't want to remember, maybe. But in any event, okay, so anyway, these are the kinds of things he was saying beforehand. And now the question is, given what we've seen since the election, both in the way of things he said and in the way of people he has appointed, and I want to go over them kind of one by one, but do things seem more coherent or less coherent? And do they seem in line with the pre-election vibe we were getting?
Yeah, the pre-election vibe
pre-election
referring
to
was
the extent
this...
that there was anything, to the extent that there was some kind of foreign policy discernible in what he said, to what extent has that been borne out by the people he's actually appointed?
But I was referring specifically to what you said about his skepticism or opposition to the Iraq war, whether you...
Well, no, but I mean more broadly, like, the inference drawn from that was that he would be, you know, a realist in certain respects, reluctant to intervene, except maybe in these special cases of bombing the hell out of ISIS or something. But my broad question is, to what extent, I mean, given what he said, another way of putting it is, given what he said before the election, have you been surprised by his picks, people like Michael Flynn, James Mattis, you know, Rex Tillerson?
Well, I think on the question of Tillerson,
and that's
very little is known about what his foreign policy views are. Some people infer a lot from the fact that he has spent his entire professional life in ExxonMobil. Mm-hmm. They assume, and you know, specifically that he has said that he's close to Vladimir Putin, and the other inference is that he must regard a good relationship with the Arab oil-producing Arab sheikdoms as an important priority. But that's all by inference, because he hasn't really ever talked about any of that other than Putin himself.
Right.
So it's hard to say. I mean, you know, I think his picks to some extent reflect the incoherence that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. Although, I mean, some of these picks, you know, have kind of specific histories or have written books, and so we get some insight into their thinking. which again isn't necessarily consistent. I mean, there, aside from Tillerson, whose views we don't know very well, there is a strong hawkishness. Certainly, Mattis is very hawkish in general, although.
And that's James Mattis, who was the apparently will be nominated for Secretary of Defense.
Right.
Tillerson would be the Secretary of State.
Right. And then you have Michael Flynn as National Security.
Like Mattis is a retired general. Mattis, a Marine, and Flynn, an Army general. And Flynn would be National Security Advisor. So why don't we look at these three people? And we should say you never know who's going to be the most influential. I mean, the National Security Advisor is right there in the White House. It's a staff position. Whether that position is the most influential foreign policy position depends on chemistry. You know, sure. Secretary of State can be the dominant figure. Secretary of Defense can weigh in heavily, and they're
the bureaucracy.
What's that? Yeah, and the interesting thing there is both Mattis and Flynn are generals, but Mattis had 4 stars and Flynn had 3.
Right.
Now, they weren't in the same branch of service, but still, that kind of thing matters a little. And I'm told that Flynn actually opposed Mattis for the position, and some people think that that was part of it. He wanted to have the most stars.
I'm sure that was a consideration, but also I think probably Mattis shares the general view, which has been reflected in the press, of the senior staff in. At the Pentagon, which is that Flynn has become a little crazy, particularly since his forced retirement in 2013 or 14, and even before that when he was still at the Defense Intelligence Agency. And I'm sure he must feel threatened by Mattis, because Mattis knows that stuff and has easy access to that stuff and will be whispered.
That stuff being what? The evidence that he's crazy?
Well, okay, I mean, I'm crazy. It's probably, well, it's not exactly.
Actually, if there's one person in the administration, aside from Trump, to whom that term might literally apply, I think it's Flynn.
It may indeed. Although, you know, one person we left out, we should just mention. I don't know if we want to go into that. But I think we don't know what kind of influence Bannon will exert. And
well,
he's
right. I mean, he's not a foreign policy. Well, you could say the same thing about Jared
Kushner.
No,
he is interested in it. Well, he is interested.
Right, but I mean, he's not formally a foreign policy advisor. That's but certainly Steve Bannon. And actually, let's pause there. I know we've got, like, too many plates spinning now, because I promised we're going to do various things. But let me pause with Bannon and tell you the coherence that I see in the foreign policy, and this occurred to me when I read an old interview with Bannon from a couple of years ago, where what was becoming evident is that he is an ethno-nationalist, not necessarily a white nationalist,
right,
but a kind of a ethno in the sense of the Judeo-Christian peoples nationalist, right? Like Judeo-Christian being America's identity. And to be honest, it could be that he's just throwing the Judeo part in there so
yeah,
that it'll actually sound more broad-minded than he actually is.
No, I think that may... I mean, I don't necessarily think he's anti-Semitic. I don't think there's any much, you know, credible specific evidence.
Well, a former
wife
said something plausible that he said
that didn't suggest
a broad love for the Jewish people.
No, but when you talk about, you know, the great victories of Judeo-Christian civilization over the Islamic hordes in the Battle
right.
of Tours
right.
and Vienna, I mean, that those
exactly.
battles
no, I think he's
Jews.
Fine. As a practical matter, I think he's fine. He's happy conceiving America's cultural ethnic identity as Judeo-Christian.
Yeah.
Not white, per se, I think.
Yes,
And he is happy, and what became clear to me in reading that interview is that he thinks the great challenge to America is from Islam, and that's when I realized that, you know, the clash of civilizations narrative, and I've been saying for a long time, like when I reviewed Samuel Harrington's book on, did I get his name right or wrong? Sam Huntington. on the Clash of Civilizations, I said the danger is that it will become a self-fulfilling prophecy. The more we think there will be a clash, there will be a clash. And at that point, I wasn't even thinking about the Islamic clash in particular. I just said, as a general matter, this can be a self-fulfilling thing. And I've been warning, you know, intermittently, not that it matters, that this would happen and it would become a self-fulfilling prophecy. And I realized when I read this Bannon thing, the moment has arrived. It is now, it has moved from being something that we are inadvertently bringing on to something that the administration is embracing. We have an administration that wants to see the world as a clash of civilizations and wants to talk about it that way. And I think if you want to contend that there is a coherence in the Trump, and I don't mean Trump himself, but in the worldview that is emerging within the Trump administration, I think that's the best candidate.
Well, certainly Flynn reflects
Flynn that. Flynn is right. Yeah, Flynn is the perfect example. And then...
And also, not just Flynn, but the Deputy National Security Advisor, K.T. McFarlane, is very much on the same wavelength.
Right.
Their communications secretary, whose name I can't remember, also a Fox News anchor or interviewer, she's right there too. That comes through very strong on the National Security Council staff, as far as we know it.
Right. I mean, for people alarmed by that, the only encouraging thing I'd say is that a fairly recent development is that they appointed the Homeland Security Advisor. That's not the head of the Department of Homeland Security, but that's the staff position. A guy named Tom Bossert from the Bush administration. I don't know much about him, but what's interesting is that Trump has chosen to elevate that to the level, the same level as the National Security Advisor. So now, unlike in the Obama administration, rather than being someone who I gather would have reported to the National Security Advisor, this will be a co-equal. And I kind of half wondered whether that was a result of people whispering in Trump's ear, hey, this Flynn guy is a real loose cannon, or people who are just concerned about Flynn lobbying to give this other guy comparable power. Now, of course, this guy's domain is Homeland Security, but that intersects with foreign policy decisions in certain ways, and it may be that there is a desire to minimize the number of times that Trump and Flynn are in a room alone talking about policy.
I mean, that could well be. I think the most dramatic, well, or potentially significant example of that is the kind of speculation over who will become Deputy Secretary of State, and especially the report that Tillerson had said he would, again, this is a report, so we don't know, we can't confirm it, that Tillerson had said he would not serve if John Bolton were named as his deputy. Right. And Bolton is definitely into the Clash of Civilizations narrative and has been for quite some time.
Right. And we should say, by the way, that your increasingly famous website, Loblog, had a little star turn in the drama involving John Bolton. Was this back when he was being considered for Secretary of State? He was being rumored to be Secretary of State, right? And then, or was this when that was no longer an option and he was being talked about as deputy?
Deputy,
okay.
Deputy.
But the New York Times had like an important story, because it was kind of a momentum-busting story, potentially,
right,
about how there's opposition building to John Bolton. And it cited something from Loblog as a good example of this well-articulated opposition. Not something you had written, but something that some
Greg Thielman, who had been in the Intelligence and Research Bureau at the State Department during the whole Iraq WMD fiasco, basically argued that, you know, if Trump is so disdainful of the CIA for giving for misassessing the WMDs in Iraq, then why would he nominate John Bolton, who was one of the people who was pushing that the most strongly within both the State Department and the Bush administration?
Right.
That was the point he was making, and it's a very important point.
It is, and it really was part of the sapping of momentum from the Bolton for Deputy Secretary crusade, which it's not over yet. We don't know who it will be, but this is an important thing, especially when you have a guy like Tillerson who doesn't have a whole lot of relevant experience, no experience in government and in the bureaucracy. It really matters, could matter who the deputy is, and that remains undecided, but certainly Bolton could lay claim to being not just as Clash of Civilizations-y as Flynn, but I think just about as crazy as Flynn.
I think Bolton is much more sophisticated, and he far more articulate than Flynn. Yeah.
You can be articulate.
On the book that I just had to read.
You can be articulate and crazy. Okay, why don't you talk about that book? Now, this is a book. This is the Flynn book, you mean?
Yeah, Flynn wrote a book, which was co-authored by Michael Ledeen.
And remind us, Michael Ledeen, he's been around forever. Didn't he show up in Watergate or something? Oh, no, was it Iran-Contra?
Yeah, but even before, I mean, before that, he was, he's an early neoconservative, close to Richard Perle, where he first became well-known was he apparently had some relationship to military intelligence in Italy, which had pretty good contacts in Libya back in the late 70s, 1980, and he contributed to what became known as Billygate, the scandal surrounding Billy Carter, Jimmy Carter's brother.
Oh, wow, I had forgotten that. I mean, Billy Carter, what I remember was Billy Carter got in trouble for trying to market Billy Beer or whatever it was. You use his connection to President Carter to create his own brand of beer and was ridiculed for that.
I think Gaddafi invited him and he had
some. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and so Ledeen kind of broke that story, or helped break it. I think back when, I think it was in the New Republic. Mm-hmm. But then he was one of the chief propagators of what became known as the Bulgarian Connection, which was this notion that the KGB was behind the attempted assassination of Pope John Paul II mm-hmm. in 1981. Do you recall that? It was the author of the Bulgarian Connection was Claire Sterling, who was an investigative reporter for Time. And then Ledeen was one of the real propagators who essentially argued that that the KGB worked through Bulgarian intelligence to hire a Turkish gunman who was a member of the Grey Wolves to attempt the assassination of Pope John Paul II early in his papacy. Because they were worried about Poland, and the Pope was Polish, and they were worried about what he would do.
Okay, so Flynn, I guess, senses enough affinity with Ledeen to have co-authored a book with him. Now, Ledeen he's a neoconservative, which isn't entirely consistent with the pre-election Trump, since neoconservatives want to crusade on behalf of democracy, and Trump rejected that. But Trump was making all these pro-Russian noises, and as you suggested, you know, neoconservatives have always been very skeptical, to put it mildly, of Soviet and then Russian intentions. So that's another kind of thing in the mix. And I guess maybe it makes it a little hard to... The fact that it's a co-authored book may make it a little hard to confidently infer what Flynn believes. On the other hand, if you don't agree with the guy, you shouldn't co-author a book with him. So,
well, I have to say, I mean, in the book, which I think was mostly written by Ledeen, because there are parts of it that get into a certain kind of esoteric and a certain kind of rhetoric that is definitely redolent of of Ledeen's previous books and articles. And blog posts. And in fact, there was an entire page that was lifted straight out of a Ledeen blog post of a year ago or something. I think Ledeen kind of wrote most of the book, and whether or not Flynn read it carefully and made corrections or suggestions, I think is unclear.
It's in Flynn's voice, right? It's like the first person pronoun is used to refer to Flynn.
Yeah, I know, but it doesn't say it was written with Michael Ledeen. It was written, and it says that they both wrote it.
Which is just odd.
Although Flynn is the headliner. But what I was going to say is, in the book itself, with respect to Russia, Flynn or Ledeen, whomever, wrote that Russia is part of the alliance of enemies that the United States faces. There are some potential common interests between the U.S. and Russia, but ultimately Russia is an enemy. Right. It's about a page and a half discussion.
Right.
But it ultimately comes down and says Russia's the part of the,
well, here's
part
a, here's
the
a, here's
coalition
a,
that wants to kill us. I don't think the word kill was used, but, you know, wants to see us dead.
Here's a quote from the book. We face a working coalition that extends from North Korea and China to Russia, Iran, Syria, Cuba, Bolivia, Venezuela, and Nicaragua. I don't know if you were unaware of the looming Bolivian and Nicaraguan threats, Jim, but there we have it. Anyway, the book goes on. We are under attack not only from nation states directly, but also from Al-Qaeda, Hezbollah, ISIS, and countless other terrorist groups. And then later it says about this aforementioned alliance of enemies. Iran is the linchpin of the alliance, its centerpiece. Later goes on to say, to be sure, an Iranian bomb would be an existential threat to Israel, but so is a non-nuclear Iran, which is the mainstay of the anti-Israel terrorist groups above all, Hamas and Islamic Jihad. So to focus solely on the nuclear question is a serious failure of strategic vision. And then later, they complain, seemingly, that no American president has yet called for regime change in Tehran. So you've got these two things, this supposedly broad alliance, China, Russia, Iran, always on the same page in their determination to destroy America. And you've got special focus on Iran. Now, which part of that do you think you can most confidently attribute to Flynn himself?
Well, I think probably just the Iran part.
Yes.
Because really the book, as I said, it addressed Russia for a page and a half, you know, weighing whether it was possible to have some cooperation with Russia. And it mentions Russia in some other contexts. You know, it provided Iran and with the nuclear plant and with respect to Syria, which he actually doesn't discuss all that much. With China, China barely comes up in the book. And aside from the passage you just read, Bolivia, Nicaragua, and Cuba don't really come up at all, except he talks a little bit about his first tour of combat duty, which took place in Grenada, and in which he recites what has come to be known as Flynn facts, which is the notion that Cuba occupied most of the island at the time of the invasion. I mean, there are a number of assertions that are, for those of us who were covering Grenada at the time and the U.S. invasion, are just nonsensical. So I would say Iran and ISIS are the main focuses, and Al-Qaeda are the main focuses of the book. That's what he's really concerned with.
And there you can see a convergence with the views of other key actors here, certainly notably James Mattis, right? I mean, for one thing, Mattis is a Marine general, and like Marine generals have a particular dislike of Iran, I gather, going back to the... Because wasn't that a Marine barracks that was bombed in the early 80s?
Yeah, in fact, I mean, there was quite a long article, I think it was in Politico, about why Mattis is so strongly anti-Iran. And it does date back to the destruction of the bombing of the Marine barracks in 1983. And and the point is that the Marines have long memories.
Mm-hmm.
And although it's also important to point out that Mattis supports the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear.
Yeah, I'm not sure he supported it in advance, but he certainly said it would be a mistake to tear it up at this point.
And that puts
him in opposition to what Trump has said, and also presumably in opposition to Flynn. I think, generally speaking, when it comes to relations with nation states, don't you imagine that Mattis would be the kind of realist that Trump... I mean, leaving Iran aside, which is a special case of antipathy, But in general, with nation states, that Mattis would actually have the kinds of realist instincts that were attributed to Trump before the election?
Yes, I think Mattis is highly hawkish, especially when it comes to Iran. But I think he also has a fundamentally realist view, albeit very hawkish. And I think that's a fair assessment. Mattis seems to have a pretty close relationship with George Shultz at the Hoover Institution, and Shultz has very similar, he was an ex-Marine too, mm-hmm. and they have very similar, I mean, from what I've heard of Mattis, they kind of have similar worldviews, including a serious dislike of hostility toward Iran, but at the same time a very kind of realist outlook, willing to criticize Israel, talks about climate change. Shultz has been more outspoken about it than Mattis, but Mattis also, you know, seems to have said some things about climate change as being a national security threat.
But when you say hawkish, I mean, when I said realist, I meant that I think Mattis would be reluctant to get into military conflict with nation states. Let's leave aside for the moment the challenge of ISIS and Al-Qaeda and so on, but I would imagine him to be reluctant to start conflicts with nation states and go for regime change and things like that. Do you think that's wrong?
I think he's probably developed, yeah.
I would think Tillerson would be on the same page. I mean, I think there's a, depending on which people become influential, I think there's a real possibility that you could wind up with a largely realist foreign policy that's centered around the Tillerson and to some extent Mattis. Although, again, the ISIS and jihadism throws a wild card into the thing that I don't totally understand.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important in that context to note that the people who recommended Tillerson as a nominee for Secretary of State were included Bob Gates, Condoleezza Rice, Jim Baker. I mean, these are all kind of
either consistent realists or people like Condi Rice who have spent much of their lives as realists.
And who were, you know, who were informed by what happened in Iraq.
Yeah.
And who then grew somewhat more modest in their foreign policy.
Well, she had been modest before it as well. She was brought up, you know, she was mentored by realists, but
yes.
She had a lapse of judgment there that unfortunately... Now at the other extreme, though, I mean, if Flynn becomes real influential, I mean, I alluded earlier to the idea of Trump and Flynn in a room alone. Can you imagine, I mean, seriously, what that conversation could be like? Like, if just something happened in the world and it's just Flynn and Trump talking about what to do, I that to me is a truly horrifying prospect.
To me as well. Yeah,
I mean,
they're both very conspiracy oriented.
And they
take things very personally. I mean, it's clear that from reading the book that Flynn is extremely angry about the way he had to leave the DIA, and he is very
that's the Defense Intelligence
Agency,
which where does that stand in the constellation of intelligence things?
Well, it's the Pentagon's. It's basically the Pentagon.
So there's the Pentagon's intelligence. There's the CIA. There's maybe some other stuff, and then there's an overarching director of all of them, right?
Yes.
Okay.
That person has not yet to be named. Although
right.
It's not clear how much power that person will have. It's possible that the office itself may be abolished. Hmm. They'll go back to the previous system. I think it's a very frightening prospect. Because they're both, I mean, they take things very personally. I mean, the way Flynn attacks Obama in the book has a very personal edge to it. So, I mean, in many ways, they meaning Trump and Flynn are a match made somewhere. But
I think heaven is not what comes.
They'll reinforce each other's views of the world in lots of ways that I find. Very.
So I guess a big question is like the people that we think definitely get some real face time with Trump, like Bannon, Jared Kushner. Are they going to be pushing him to take Flynn seriously? Or are they going to be warning him about Flynn? And that's not totally clear to me.
I don't think it's clear at all. I mean, really, Flynn and Bannon have more or less, and
yeah, I feel
and the family have really kind of disappeared from public view, at least in a policy sense. We just know they're participating in meetings of various kinds. Yeah. And Bannon, I find a very confusing character because, again, in the interview, are you talking about his Vatican?
Yeah, I believe so. It was like 2014.
Yeah. I mean, that was very, because it wasn't just like Islam is the great enemy in the clash of civilizations. It's also like Wall Street and Goldman Sachs
right.
are the great enemy. And then you turn around and he's not asserting himself in the selection of various nominees, or that was just a cynical populist ploy, and he loves Goldman Sachs and Wall Street and so on. I mean, I can't figure that out. When you have the economic appointments uh-huh. for the most part thus far are especially pleasing to Wall Street, which is why you see bank stocks, you know, getting yeah. record highs. I mean, how can Bannon be happy about that if he was at all sincere in that interview? I don't know.
But I sense that he is sincere. I mean, I think he is a genuine economic nationalist, certainly a nativist. A guy who's not just concerned about Mexicans migrating from the South, but about South Asians coming in and taking executive positions in Silicon yeah. Valley. He is. Yeah. I mean, he is a thoroughgoing nativist, and I think ethno-nationalist is fair. And I think there's good reason to believe that that's all heartfelt. And then the context of that one interview led him to connect that to a broader global struggle. I mean, the ethno-nationalism, fits in with economic nationalism. These things are commonly found together, as they were with Pat Buchanan. And then in that interview, I didn't see any reason to doubt him when he linked that up to a kind of a clash of civilizations, this coming great struggle with Islamic civilization. Now,
yeah, and before we leave Bannon again, I think it's worth noting, I mean, what really worries me about him on the foreign policy, and aside from the clash of civilizations, is that he seems to be very, very focused on what's happening in Europe. The other side of mm-hmm. our ethno-nationalist whatever.
The Brexiters and the Marine Le Pens.
Yeah, and I mean, you've got, essentially, there's a project or multiple projects, so to speak, by different actors who are potentially quite powerful, all directed against the continued survival and health of the European Union as an entity. You have Putin, you have Bannon, who clearly is really interested in this.
Yeah.
And for that matter, you have some, I mean, not as powerful, but you have someone like Netanyahu and his supporters in the United States, like Adelson, who also hate the EU and would love to see, the Union
right.
disappear, or at least become even more impotent than it is already. And I really worry about that because you've got a series of important elections in Europe, and if Putin is insinuates himself into that, and the White House gets involved in undermining somebody like Angela Merkel at this point, I mean, you have to see the EU's situation as very precarious. And that worries me a lot, too.
I had not thought about that. I mean, I had thought about Bannon's identification with the right-wing nationalist nativist people in Europe as part of a larger opposition to cosmopolitanism and globalization. In other words, an expression, a natural expression of his own nationalism. I hadn't realized that he might have as a specific goal the destruction of the European Union. But, it's funny, you know, another show on Blogging Heads, the DMZ, it's kind of a left-right dialogue between Bill Scheer and Matt Lewis. And Matt Lewis, some weeks ago, said he had met Bannon, he knew him just slightly. This was months ago, it was before the election, I think. Yeah, it was. And he said he's prone to grandiosity. He's you can see him taking on a project like the destruction of the European Union. It's just like, right? I mean, some of us would think, well, I'm not worthy, you know? It's like, that's a little too, that's too big a goal. But I think, you know, I think he thinks in those terms. I mean, I think he wants to, you know, shift the direction of history.
Yeah, if he talks about the Battle of Tours and the Battle of Vienna,
those are warning signs
as our civilization's, you know, finest moments and something to which we should presumably aspire. I think it's fair to say, Bob, that you know he has some big ideas.
He's a big thinker. Yeah. He's a hedgehog, not a fox. So this is kind of alarming. I think you're right. I mean, Bannon is not a foreign policy figure per se, but it's right. We're right to focus on him because if he preserves influence in the administration, you know, he's thinking about this big picture foreign policy stuff a lot more than Jared Kushner is, a lot more than Kellyanne Conway is. You know, if you look at the kind of generic advisors who could influence Trump and tell him who to pay attention to and not. To pay attention to, he is probably the one to watch.
I mean, he could be. On the other hand, again, you look at some of those appointments and you say, well, if Bannon was telling the truth about how he felt about Wall Street and Goldman Sachs and hedge funds in that interview at the Vatican, then what kind of power is he exerting?
Well, yeah, but he doesn't consider the Treasury as important an appointment precisely because he's got his eye on foreign policy in the whole globe. I mean, Treasury's not that important.
Oh, it is important. I don't agree.
You mean because of its role in sanctions and things like that, or what?
Well, in part, yeah, sanctions, but also, you know, it gets the critical vote in certain multilateral fora, which are very important in tying the world together, such as the IMF and the World Bank. Not as important as they were in the 1980s, but still very relevant factors. These are multilateral fora that in which Treasury has historically exerted a lot of influence.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure Bannon would necessarily know that based on
but
his background.
Would,
but
I mean,
the other thing is,
Goldman Sachs. He knows the world of finance.
Right, and I mean, I don't think the. Well, anyway, I don't know, but also as a practical matter, you know, it's very unusual that one advisor gets everything that he or she wants. You got to do some horse trading, and you got to, you know, there are a lot of people talking to Trump, and there are a number of them that he trusts. Certainly, Jared Kushner, and so he's not going to get everything he wants. But you know, and I would say Rex Tillerson doesn't look like what Bannon would have ordered up, right? Precisely because I would infer, and not just based on what he said, but based on who we know recommended him, that he's a little more of a cautious realist than
right.
Bannon wants to see.
Yeah, no, I agree. I suspect, you know, again, we don't know what Trump's decision-making process is, but we do know that he's rather impulsive and that he has a very... And that he has a certain image of himself. And, you know, some of the speculation in the press has been that, you know, he's very impressed by certain people, especially by, you know, large men who seem to have a certain power about them and who have strong views, you know, who aren't necessarily, you know, who are rather... who speak rather directly, mm-hmm. You know, and don't pull any punches. And so, I mean, he could be making some of these hiring decisions not on the basis of policy or worldview, but on the basis of being really impressed by someone's, you know, charisma or presence or whatever.
Well, relatedly, an interesting question is, like, why so many generals? I think this is just about unprecedented. In addition to a former general's national security advisor, you've got a former general as Secretary of Defense, which is supposed to be, it's supposed to be that you can't have a recent military person as Secretary of Defense, so he's going to have to get a congressional exemption to do this. And then you've got John Kelly, a retired Marine general, as Secretary of Homeland Security. So you got three.
And Pompeo at CIA. I mean, he was never a general, but he was an Army officer.
So what?
And he went to West Point.
So would you attribute that? And by the way, this is something I could imagine attributing to Bannon. Bannon is a former military guy, in addition to being a former Wall Street guy, and you know. I mean, what is your? Do you have an explanation for why there are so many generals? It's really an aberration historically.
Well, Trump went to military school.
Yeah, and then spent the and then succeeded in dodging actual military service.
But Bob, I mean, we've mentioned Pompeo just now in passing, but he's someone else who, while Democrats say they consider him relatively reasonable and someone they can work with, you know, he is a Tea Party guy who's said some very, you know, Islamophobic kinds of things. And I imagine he must, he probably subscribes to a similar, if more refined and not as strident a worldview as Flynn, mm-hmm, and Bannon. And that's the head of CIA, so that's a real problem, because now you're kind of back in Iraq territory, where the manipulation of intelligence becomes something that that becomes a possibility. I mean, generally speaking, you don't want someone who's head of CIA who has a very fixed worldview and may not be particularly open to alternative worldviews. Yeah. Again, I don't think Pompeo is as dogmatic. The indications are he's not nearly as dogmatic as Flynn or Bannon, but he has said some rather troubling things.
Yeah. And then, speaking of things that trouble at least one person, John Kelly said something that bothered me. I mean, he's Secretary of Homeland Security, and he was quoted, this is something he had said in the past, but, you know, about jihadists saying, "I don't know why they hate us, and I don't care." Now, yeah, that to me is exactly the wrong attitude for a Homeland Security Director. It seems to me you would want the Homeland Security Director to be, or Secretary, to be curious about what kinds of things turn, like, particularly American citizens into jihadists. You know, it's something that happens. They're not born that way.
Yeah.
It's a process of radicalization. The idea that the Secretary of Homeland Security has no curiosity about that scares me, not just because it's in his domain, but because an unrestrained Secretary of Homeland Security can do things that radicalize Muslims. If he comes out in favor of pervasive surveillance of mosques and so on, I think that's going to be bad. And or at least can get exactly that kind of blowback. To me, that's...
And I think, again, in the Flynn book, you know, there's really no discussion of what motivates jihadis, or, you know, it's not even a matter of curiosity on his part. It's just not, you know, after 9/11, there was all this talk about root causes and why do they hate us and so on. And I mean, that was considered an appropriate question. But for Flynn, for someone like Flynn, it's like irrelevant. The idea is you capture or kill them. That's what you do.
Yeah. Well, that's the implication. I mean, if you're not at all concerned with what creates them, that's kind of your only option. I would guess that James Mattis might have, maybe among these people, one of the more, this is just wishful thinking maybe, but maybe one of the more sophisticated views on this. I would guess that he actually thinks about what makes terrorist recruiting easier and what makes it harder, based partly on some things he said about Israel, but...
No, and the fact that he carries around a copy of Marcus Aurelius.
Oh, does he?
Well, it's always on his bedside, apparently.
You could do worse.
No, of course. I think that's good. And what's interesting, again, I think it, to some extent, I mean, you know, his reputation is a bit fearsome, but obviously what really impressed Trump when he made the announcement that Mattis was going to be a Secretary of Defense was his nickname, because stressed Mad Dog. I mean, he was so excited by this image. That should be another reassuring indication of where we may be going.
That was a good career move on his part. Maybe I need a better nickname. Mad Bob just doesn't sound the same. But it fits. So here's a quick question that is kind of relevant to all this. There's a little bit of an asymmetry that in Trump's treatment of Russia and China. Now, with Russia, he's like not at all moralistic. He doesn't complain that Russia's trying to deprive the Ukrainian people the right of self-determination or anything. It's totally realpolitik. Whereas with China, it's like, well, the Taiwanese people, you know, we must speak up on behalf of the Taiwanese people. Although later it kind of walks that back by saying, well, maybe we could do a deal with China. But still, there is an asymmetry in that he's treating Russia in a classically almost hyper-realist fashion. Like, we don't care about your values or who you conquer or murder as long as you don't, you know, as long as you behave in ways that are consistent with our interests. With China, he's singing a pretty appreciably different tune. Now, there are various explanations for this. One is that China, being a more significant economic player, has led him to ramp up the trade, you know, the trade war talk. Another is that, you know, the one about his personal connection to Russia, which, you know, sometimes approaches the level of conspiracy theory, I think, although he does have some financial connections to Russia. Then there's the actual ethno-nationalist one, which is that in a clash of civilizations, Russia, being a Christian nation, is on our side against the terrorists, whereas China isn't. Do you have a preferred theory there?
No, I don't think I have a preferred theory. I mean, there's some speculation that, yeah, he's pulling a Nixon, except in the other way, mm-hmm. that he realizes that at some level, he, Trump, realizes that China is the only real potential global rival of the United States, and therefore, that the relationship will inevitably be a hostile one. And therefore, you ally with its neighbor against it. And as another, you know, major power in any event. So that theory is out there. I tend to see it as partly, you know, populism. He felt he was going to win on people's feelings of their people losing their jobs, and where did they lose their jobs. I mean, I see that partly as opportunistic, but I think there may be a clash of civilizations element to it. I mean, I haven't heard Bannon talk about China, but I think it's probably, to the extent that he sees the world in that way, he probably sees China as threatening. Yeah. And Flynn doesn't talk much about China. It's pretty clear he doesn't really know much about China. But the fact that he includes China without any question in this alliance of enemies or coalition of enemies as something that's taken for granted, in a sense. Mm-hmm. Unlike Russia, where he says there could be some, you know, common basis for cooperation, but ultimately they're against us, they want us dead. Mm-hmm. With China, there's, along with Bolivia, there's no question that China's a rival. And that's it's interesting because, again, Wall Street can't be happy to hear that kind of talk. And it's very dangerous talk. I mean, when we were talking about Israel early on as being, you know, as possibly a major point of crisis, I mean, China is, and Taiwan are major points of crisis, as is North Korea. I mean, China, as you know, just yesterday, you know, sent their aircraft carrier out beyond and within 90 miles of Taiwan, and that hasn't happened before. And there's a lot of tension in the South China Sea.
Yeah. But it's interesting, you know, I mean, as far as Bannon and China, I mean, first of all, his, you know, if the economic nationalism is sincere, you can, that could, again, help explain his being warier of China than than Russia. But, you know, it's also interesting. I've heard him, you know, he has complained about immigrants from South Asia, at least. I don't know about East Asia. I haven't heard him complain about Russian immigrants, and yet there have been a Silicon Valley, you can find more than a few Russian immigrants, you know. Now, maybe they tend not, are not as likely to be CEOs as Indians are, say, but I'd be curious as to whether, you know, whether immigration from Christian nations bothers him the way immigration from other nations does.
I suspect not.
Yeah, I do too. So, So time's just about up, I guess. But I would like to hear, before we go, do you have like an apocalypse scenario? Is there a specific vision of something unfolding that is the worst case scenario and yet at least somewhat plausible given what we're seeing here?
I think, Bob, you alluded to a scenario where Flynn and Trump are have to make a big decision really quickly, and they're together, and they can't consult with Tillerson or anyone else. Yeah, that scares the hell out of me. So that's pretty apocalyptic. I mean, I can see, all kinds of minor incidents turning into big escalations really fast. In major part, because Trump himself is so impulsive. Mm-hmm. I mean, if he feels his manhood is under question, and it has to do with a military confrontation of some kind, be it in the Straits of Hormuz, with Iranian speedboats, you know, hassling American destroyers, or whether it's in the South China Sea with a much more impressive local power, China, you know, behaving aggressively toward U.S. Navy or U.S. spy planes, like took place in 2001, where a spy plane, you know, a Chinese fighter got too close to a U.S. spy plane and went down, and the spy plane was then taken to Hainan Island. Or forced to fly to Hainan Island and held there for a week or so. I mean, I can see these incidents as escalating very rapidly with a man as impulsive as Trump, especially if he's surrounded by people who are kind of, in some respects, spoiling for a fight.
Yeah.
Of one kind or another. I can also see third-party provocateurs provoking.
False flag something. Operations? Yeah. Or.
But the escalation could be very, very fast, and anything of a military nature could soon essentially escalate out of control.
Yeah, that's right. I think China was actually wise to seize that little robotic sea craft because I think they realized, they wanted to send Trump a signal, I think, and they realized that if they wait until he's president, then to save face, you know, He's going to do God knows what, and they wanted to let him know beforehand that they can be expected to save face too, basically, and that you can't, you know, that there would be wisdom on his part in an implied non-aggression pact with China.
Yeah, I think one of the great dangers is that countries with whom we do not share a number of interests, but the militaries of those countries operate close to ours. I think there may be a great danger in senior levels of those governments not understanding fully how impulsive and how uninformed the President of the United States is. And taking for granted that because he's President of the United States, he must have a lot of people who know a lot around him and are advising him very closely not to do stupid things. I think they may make a presumption that may not be warranted, and that worries me.
Yeah. Well, I guess my own nominee for apocalypse is the ongoing development of the clash of civilizations as a self-fulfilling prophecy, and specifically our continuing to do what we have done since 9/11, which is do things that make the problem of jihadism worse. That's what the Iraq invasion did. That's what the Libya thing did, especially once it turned into a regime change operation, at which point it also exceeded the UN mandate. And I think, you know, a totally unappreciated fact is that had we and our allies, I'm not sure we could have arranged in Syria to restrain our allies like Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Qatar. But had we not armed the opposition, had that not become a regime change operation, we would be in a much better place with jihadism in general. So the moral of all those stories is, you know, no regime change. But I think going forward, regime change is not what we have to worry. I don't think it's what Trump's going to be up to, but I think he's going to find things to do that will make the jihadism worse. In things he says about Islam, in things the Homeland Security Secretary does, and in what will probably be a ham-handed approach to fighting ISIS, I would guess.
And confronting Iran.
And confronting Iran. That's exactly right. And that is the one kind of nation state. If you had to worry about one nation state situation as opposed to jihadism diffusely, that might be it. And it's, you know, not totally unconnected to it, although not in the way that people often think. I mean, the jihadism tends to be Sunni, and Iran tends to be kind of fighting that. But
well, that's what's really also kind of really worrisome is that somebody like K.T. McFarlane, the Deputy National Security Advisor, I've seen interviews that she's carried out in which she belies a failure to understand essentially the difference between Sunnis and Shias. I mean, you know, as late as 2010 or 11. And Mattis, in his April speech at CSIS, Center for Strategic and International Studies here, in talking about the Middle East, all he could talk about was Iran, and one of the points he made was, we've kind of dedicated too much attention to Sunni radicalism. We need to pay more attention to Shia radicalism.
Wow.
By which he, of course, meant Iran and Hezbollah. So these are things that worry, that also contribute to my great sense of anxiety, if not dread.
Certainly, if you pick out all of the... If we go to war with all the enemies that one or another of the key foreign players, foreign policy players, is focused on, we'll be at war with a whole lot of people. I mean, you know, because others are focused on the Sunni jihadism,
right?
And then some are both, like Flynn. You know, maybe the final, if there's a source of hope, I think. You know, Deputy Secretary of State position hasn't been filled yet. There's some talk of somebody like Richard Haass. I've never been a huge Richard Haass fan, but in this context, he would, God knows, be a breath of fresh air, you know. So, you know, if you got somebody like that as Deputy Secretary and the influence at state and maybe to some extent defense outweighed the influence from the National Security Advisor, maybe that's a hopeful. You know, another hopeful scenario in some context is actual Russia. I mean, Trump has been talking as if he doesn't understand that Russia and Iran, in the biggest conflict going on now, are on the same side. He, like, wants to buddy up with Russia and destroy Iran. And you would expect Russia, if indeed it stays in his good graces, to do some lobbying to take it easy on Iran. Not that Russia and Iran have a really deep and broad-based alliance. I mean, it's to some extent opportunistic involving Syria, but still, you might expect that. Russia, you know, has supported the Iran deal. And you might hope that he'll hear some of that from Rex Tillerson as well. Tillerson doesn't have much of a history, but we know that Tillerson, at least as head of Exxon, was anti-sanctions.
Remember, the same could be said for Vice President Cheney.
I mean, you can always these conversion experiences can definitely be problematic. But I'm trying to find rays of hope and restraining influences. You can imagine Tillerson being one. You can imagine, in some context, Russia being one.
It's possible, but you know, I mean, Putin is a very, I mean, and also Iran is a big consumer of Russian weapons, which are important to the Russian economy.
Right.
But then you look at the flirtation going on between Russia and Turkey, and you know that Turkey and Iran are not getting along well together, and you wonder, well, what kind of game may you be playing there? I mean, yeah, I think it's right to look for rays of hope wherever you can find them. But I
Turkey wasn't getting along with Russia 9 months ago. I mean, Turkey, you know, the hostility between Turkey and Iran doesn't seem to be built into the logic of the situation deeply. But,
no, I mean, I'm just saying Putin can be quite flexible, I think, and has shown a degree of flexibility that may undercut the ray of hope that you're talking about. That was just one example.
Oh, final question.
Yeah.
Scenario I actually don't take very seriously, maybe I should, is the finger on the nuclear button scenario. Do you worry about actual nuclear war?
You know, during the Cold War, even during the Cuban Missile Crisis, somehow I got through that. I think I was 13 at the time. And I never really felt threatened. But maybe that's because I was in Seattle and I thought the Soviet Union was really far away. Even though it wasn't when I realized that Siberia was closer than I had thought. But I don't know. It's just that Trump seems so ignorant and is so unpredictable. It does worry me a little bit. Mm. It does.
Okay, on that note.
I'm sorry.
Happy New Year. Thanks.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks for this. Everybody should read Low Blog, which draws on many, many contributors, many of them like, you know, real players in foreign policy, past and present, who really know their stuff.
And we did excerpt substantial portions of Flynn's book, so if you wouldn't have to necessarily buy it, if you were curious about
yeah,
what
do,
you think.
Do deprive him of the revenue, by all means.
Yeah.
Okay, well, so thank you, Jim, and maybe we'll have you back, you know, after enough time has passed to see how horrific things have turned out to be.
My pleasure, Bob. Okay. Always a pleasure.
Always. Okay, take care. Happy New Year.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.